further, deeper structuralised racism into British society.
In addition to the anti-BDS remarks, Patel laid bare her so-called unflinching support to Israel. This comes just days after the shock killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhila by Israeli regime forces, making it appear that no matter what crimes are being committed, Tel Aviv can rely on unwavering support from the British Home Office. Robert Carter, London.
On Friday, about 2,000 people staged a rally in the Italian capital calling on the Mario Draghi government and the EU to stop sending weapons to Kyiv and finally promote peace talks to resolve the war in Ukraine. The initiative had been called by a number of base unions and supported by a string of leftist movements. People at the rally expressed high concern over the serious military escalation by all parties involved in the Ukraine conflict.
The EU is not acting right. Its wary posture has only put one bloc against another. The people are those who will suffer from our rulers' decisions in the end.
There are too many conflicting interests at stake, and Italy is far too servile. The EU should do more. I don't support Putin, but I'm also against Zelensky. He is not acting in the interests of the Ukrainians.
Following the start of the conflict in Ukraine, Italy has opted to gradually cut its gas reliance on Russia. Rome has been importing gas from Moscow for over 50 years, and about 45% of its total demand is provided by Russia.
I'm a small retailer. I was forced to close down during the COVID, but I haven't seen a cent of support from the government. And now they spend billions for the war. When will they look after us?
Undoubtedly, the Italian government is far too aligned with NATO, but it's not just that. The government is very much distant from the people, as surveys show the majority of the Italians are against the war.
Since the start of the conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown half of the Italians oppose the sending of weapons to Ukraine and believe sanctions against Russia are useless. About one-fifth of the surveyed Italians have so far said they are in support of the Draghi government's delivery of heavy weapons to Kyiv.
The conflict in Ukraine, its dire consequences and the fear it could spread or go on for a long time are not the only worries Italians are concerned with. Rising inflation, a growing cost of energy, blocked salaries, continual crumbling of purchasing power, all economic indicators are pointing towards a recession. Many expect the country to be faced with a hot autumn of strikes and protests. Max Civili, Rome.
A UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer has been hit with a series of disruptive direct action protests in retaliation to recent Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Palestine Action have intensified their long-running campaign against Elbit Systems, with activists trashing sites in London and Bristol.
Elbit Systems is a notorious Israeli arms manufacturer with locations dotted all across the UK. Their HQ, located just behind me, is a popular target for Palestine Action, who claim that their activities is focused on disrupting their production activities. Elbit is known for producing up to 85% of Israel's drone fleet, after all.
Israeli crimes against Palestinians has circulated world headlines in recent weeks, particularly surrounding the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akhila, shot dead by Israeli regime forces as she documented an Israeli assault on a Palestinian refugee camp on the 11th of May. The killing occurred just days before the Nakba, an annual date which marks the ethnic cleansing of native Palestinians from their homeland. Elbit's recent response stated,
Elbit Systems UK is proud to provide advanced support for the UK armed forces. Attempting to disrupt this work during a time of heightened global instability is dangerous and highly irresponsible.
However, speaking to Press TV, the activists rubbish Elbit's stance.
How many lives have they saved compared to how many lives they've taken, would be my question. They are responsible for so many deaths of men, women and children. How could you possibly think that that's in any way security? It's illegal. It's a crime. All of these things are criminal, and yet it's when you're out there doing something that you're shown as the criminal, essentially. And I've always found that very interesting as a narrative.
With Palestine action vowing to continue and Israel's occupation persisting, many expect to see more spilling of red paint, but also more Palestinian blood too. Robert Carter, London.
Once again, crimes committed by the Israeli regime have been debated in the European Parliament. Lawmakers condemn the brutal murder on the 11th of May of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. She was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier.
Too often we, here in Europe, look away when the spiral of violence continues, when new settlements plans are announced, or when another journalist gets killed or wounded.
Clearly wearing press attire, 51-year-old Abu Akleh was murdered in cold blood while covering an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. During her funeral, Israeli forces attacked mourners.
The European Union is appalled by the events that took place during the funeral procession. The EU condemned this disproportionate use of force and disrespectful behavior.
Western media and Western leaders have been accused of turning a blind eye to the international law violations continuously perpetrated by the apartheid Israeli regime in the occupied territories.
Increased settler violence around the settlements, clashes at the holy sites in Jerusalem during the Ramadan, forced evictions and demolitions in the West Bank, including of EU-funded projects.
Tel Aviv has been urged to fully cooperate with an independent inquiry into Shireen's murder. The EU says that's important in order to maintain the bloc's close partnership with Israel.
When situations like this arise, we say it is very important for this partnership to continue in its high quality, that we have clarity about things that are happening, which are actually against our principles and our values.
EU legislators urge the West not to give up on the idea of a two-state solution to end the Israel-Palestine conflict.
The tragic death of Shireen Abu Akleh is a sad reminder of the spiral of violence taking place that continues to haunt this region.
The European Parliament debate heard that Israel has killed around 50 Palestinian journalists during the past two decades. It goes without saying then that Shireen was not the first and almost certainly will not be the last. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Months after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, the U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, confessed that Washington was mainly to blame for the collapse of the former Afghan government and national security and defense forces. The report by SIGAR reveals that Afghan forces' morale were destroyed after then-U.S. President Donald Trump reached a deal with the Taliban in 2020, and President Joe Biden affirmed the U.S. withdrawal in 2021.
In my opinion, the Doha deal paved the way for the U.S.-led foreign forces' withdrawal from Afghanistan. It also gave the Taliban forces the belief that they can take over Afghanistan easily. In fact, the Doha deal and the U.S. withdrawal both were great achievements for the Taliban and Afghanistan.
Former Afghan generals and experts also told the agency that most American support to Afghan forces was stopped or limited, while the Taliban had intensified attacks.
I agree with the SIGAR report. The former Afghan Republic government was defeated when the U.S. signed a deal with the Taliban. After the Doha deal, the U.S. stopped its major logistics support, including fuel, rockets, arms, and air support to Afghan forces. It continued until the Afghan army completely ran out of equipment.
SIGAR notes that in essence, U.S. and Afghan efforts to cultivate an effective and sustainable security assistance sector were likely to fail from the beginning. Afghan experts also say that the U.S. never meant to build a nation or a state in the country, and all Western-backed armies are doomed to failure.
The former Afghan government was an example of American state-building. They invaded our country, formed their own government, and finally demolished it. They never meant to boost the state-nation process. The Americans appointed their own men to the Afghan government, while they were not representing Afghan people. In addition, the U.S. intentionally established a corrupt and dependent army in Afghanistan.
The Taliban took over Afghanistan in August 2021, as the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan and the former Western-backed government collapsed. Afghans are angry with the U.S. for pushing Afghanistan into a dire situation.
People here believe Washington not only betrayed Afghans, but also continues to harm them with sanctions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In Indian-controlled Kashmir, a recent order by the authorities is giving sleepless nights to many business owners and shopkeepers. Business owners, big and small, are spending hundreds of dollars each to install security cameras, a mandatory move ordered by the authorities. The official order says the scheme will deter criminals, antisocial and anti-national elements. The order also outlines the minimum standards for camera resolution, infrared capability and range. The government's order has been highly criticized by business owners. They describe the move as a callous approach towards war-weary Kashmir's fractured business establishments, which were deeply dented after India cancelled Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019.
Everybody knows the quantum of the business, it's almost 80% down. It was their duty to install the CC camera. Why to tell to the business you install the CCTV cameras? You see, the 80% of the business company, they cannot afford to install this CCTV camera. So I think they should review this decision and they should look into this.
Muzaffar Jan, a shop owner in the heart of Srinagar's busiest market, Lal Chowk, says it has been days since he has seen a customer at his store. However, to follow the police instructions, he was forced to pull out the money he had saved for running his household.
I waited for around a week to see whether others would install cameras. Later, I was forced because of continuous announcements and strict orders. I installed the camera. It took me around $1,000, and not everyone can afford this cost. In Kashmir, there are frequent power cuts, and to keep the camera plugged in, I had to install an uninterrupted power supply inverter. Many of us can't manage two meals a day. How can we afford these cameras?
The order further instructs that the cameras installed at the business owner's expense must always stay on. The system should record and store footage for 30 days and must be produced on demand of police and other law enforcement agencies without any court order. And failure to abide by the order will result in a fine or month-long imprisonment. The level of surveillance in Kashmir is increasing day by day. Authorities argue that the measure will help them protect people's lives. But Kashmiris are calling the move as a worrying development and see it as a threat to their human rights, privacy and dignity. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
In the limelight.
In Georgia, United States, David Perdue challenged Governor Brian Kemp because of Donald Trump's fury over his 2020 election loss. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Reed Epstein and Shane Goldmacher. The piece is titled, Perdue Had Trump, in Georgia, Kemp Had Everything Else. September of 2021, former Senator David Perdue was hemming and hawing about running for governor of Georgia. Over dinner with an old friend on Sea Island, he pulled out his iPhone and showed the list of calls he'd gotten from Donald J. Trump, lobbying him to take the plunge. He said Donald Trump called him all the time, said Martha Zoller, a former aide to Mr. Perdue, who now hosts a talk radio show in Gainesville, Georgia. Martha Zoller added, he showed me on his iPhone these multiple recent calls and said they were from the former president. Martha Zoller and a legion of other former Perdue aides and advisers told the former senator that running was a bad idea. He listened to Donald Trump instead. Now David Perdue is staring down an epic defeat at the hands of Governor Brian Kemp, the Republican whom Donald Trump has blamed for his 2020 loss, more than any other person. The Purdue campaign is ending the race low on cash, with no advertisements on television and a candidate described even by his supporters as lackluster and distracted. Purdue thought that Trump was a magic wand, said Newt Gingrich, the former House Speaker and a Trump ally, who was among David Perdue's highest-profile Georgia supporters. In retrospect, it's hard to understand David Perdue's campaign, and it's certainly not the campaign those of us who were for him expected. Mr. Perdue's impending downfall in Tuesday's primary for governor in Georgia looms as the biggest electoral setback for Donald Trump since his own defeat in the 2020 presidential election. There is perhaps no contest in which the former president has done more to try to influence the outcome. Mr. Trump recruited, promoted, and cleared the field for his ally while assailing Brian Kemp, recording television advertisements and giving $2.64 million to groups helping David Perdue, by far the most he has ever invested in another politician. Yet the race has exposed the limits of Donald Trump's sway, especially against entrenched Republican incumbents. David Perdue's failures were not just of his own making. He was outflanked by a savvy incumbent in Brian Kemp, who exploited the powers of his office to cut off David Perdue from allies, including Mr. Perdue's own cousin, Sonny, a former governor and Trump agriculture secretary, whom Brian Kemp's allies appointed chancellor of the University System of Georgia. Governor Brian Kemp also appeared to punish those who crossed him. One congressional seat was drawn to exclude the home of a candidate whose father, a Perdue supporter, had publicly criticized the governor. And he offered goodies to voters, including a gas tax holiday that conveniently runs through to the end of May, just past the primary. On Thursday, 19th of May, as David Perdue campaigned outside the Semper Fi Bar and Grill in Woodstock, Georgia, he was not conjuring up a path to victory, but haggling over the scope of his widely expected defeat after a Fox News Channel survey showed him down 32 percentage points on his rival. "Hell no, I'm not down 30 points," insisted David Perdue, whose campaign did not respond to requests for comment for this article. "We may not win on Tuesday," he added, "but I will guarantee you we are not down 30 points. The key threshold on Tuesday is 50%. Brian Kemp must win an outright majority in the five-candidate field to avoid a one-on-one runoff in June." The story of David Perdue's efforts is less one of political collapse and more of a failure to launch. From the moment he announced his candidacy in December, Mr. Perdue never demonstrated the same commitment to winning that he displayed in his first Senate race back in 2014. His case for ousting Brian Kemp was always largely based on support from the former president, Donald Trump. Mr. Perdue argued at his campaign introduction that the governor had so alienated the party's Trump faithful that they would not rally around Mr. Kemp against Stacey Abrams, the presumptive Democratic nominee and a leading villain for Republicans. But Mr. Perdue, a 72-year-old, a wealthy former chief executive of Dollar General, never came close to matching the $3.8 million of his own money he put into his 2014 Senate race. He invested just $500,000 in his bid for governor of Georgia. That is less than he and his wife spent last year for a waterfront lot on a secluded peninsula on scenic St. Simon's Island, a purchase made not long after his runoff defeat at the hands of a then 33-year-old Democrat that delivered Senate control to Democrats. A permit to build a nearly 12,000-square-feet mansion worth an estimated $5 million on land including over 625 feet of lake frontage, according to the listing, was granted 2 weeks after he declared his candidacy, according to records. Donald Trump has simultaneously invested heavily in Mr. Perdue with his $2.64 million and sought to avoid blame as the candidate has faltered, telling the New York Times in April that the news media's focus should be on the endorsements, not the David Perdue one, to measure his influence. Donald Trump's last rally in Georgia came in late March. He did not return to Georgia, as Perdue allies had hoped, instead holding a conference call for supporters in early May. "I am with David all the way because Brian Kemp was the worst governor in the country on election integrity," Donald Trump insisted on Friday on his Truth Social messaging platform. David Perdue, like candidates for governor in Idaho and Nebraska this month, learned that a Trump endorsement does not assure the support of Trump voters or Trump donors. "The Trump endorsement is very important, but it's only an endorsement," said former Representative Jack Kingston, who lost the 2014 Senate primary to David Perdue and is a former Trump advisor. "It's not an army of infrastructure and door knockers the way it would be if you have the Sierra Club or the NRA or the AFL-CIO. The juxtaposition between the Kemp and Perdue camps was particularly stark on Friday. Mr. Kemp was outside Savannah, Georgia, announcing that Hyundai was investing $5.5 billion in an electric battery and vehicle manufacturing plant, one of the largest economic development projects in Georgia's history. David Perdue was nearby holding an endorsement event with Sarah Palin, the 2008 Republican vice presidential nominee, who is making her own comeback attempt in a House race in Alaska. "I would rather be standing on the stage announcing 7,500 jobs than standing next to Sarah Palin," said Brian Kemp's Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, a fierce Trump critic who opted not to run for re-election this year. Randy Evans, a Perdue supporter who served as ambassador to Luxembourg in the Trump administration, said the Kemp operation had been ruthless in using what he called the bullying powers of the governorship. Randy Evans' son, Jake, is running for Congress in the Atlanta suburbs. "When Kemp-aligned Republican legislators drew new lines in redistricting, the younger Mr. Evans was suddenly drawn out of the district in which he had been planning to run. They cut a sliver about the size of your little finger," the elder Mr. Evans said. "Jake had to move, buy a new house." Brian Kemp, a 58-year-old, leveraged the powers of incumbency in other crucial ways. He signed the measure to provide tax refunds of up to $500 for married couples, then announced on 11th of May, after early voting had begun, that those checks were in the mail. He appealed to rural Georgians by raising pay for teachers and pleased conservatives by signing sweeping legislation to restrict voting access, to expand gun rights, and forbid school mask mandates. David Perdue's efforts could seem feeble in comparison. In March, he attacked Brian Kemp for recruiting an electric truck maker to open a factory in rural Georgia, creating thousands of jobs, because George Soros, the prominent Democratic donor, had recently invested in the company. The Kemp-Perdue contest was steeped in the drama of personal betrayal. Brian Kemp had spent weeks campaigning with David Perdue before the senator's defeat in the January 2021 Senate runoff election. By then, Brian Kemp had infuriated Donald Trump by defending the legitimacy of Georgia's presidential results. Last spring, Brian Kemp's aide said David Perdue assured Brian Kemp that he did not intend to run for governor. That June, Mr. Perdue introduced the governor at the Georgia Republican Party's annual convention. But Brian Kemp cannily had already begun the process of installing Sonny Perdue, a popular former governor, to run Georgia's state universities, an appointment that effectively put him on the sidelines. Sonny Perdue, through a spokesperson, declined to comment. Brian Kemp also preemptively secured the loyalty and fundraising might of Alec Poitvent, a South Georgia businessman who had served as campaign chairman for David Perdue's Senate campaigns and Sonny Perdue's campaigns for governor. One of many ways, the Brian Kemp operation boxed out David Perdue financially. Mr. Poitvent said he was among a host of longtime David Perdue supporters who had urged him not to run. Shunned by the state's political establishment, David Perdue tried framing himself as a political outsider. "I've been an outsider since I got into politics," he said on Thursday. But that is a difficult case to make for a former senator boasting of his support from a former president.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It is the first anniversary of Operation Al-Quds Sword, which was launched last year by resistance groups of the Gaza Strip against Israel. Head of the Political Bureau of the Palestinian Hamas Resistance Movement, Ismail Haniyeh, has said that the operation opened a new chapter in the fight against the occupying regime of Israel. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at in what ways this new chapter has been opened and why conclusions have been made that Israel has become weaker and more vulnerable. Let's find out more about this from first our correspondent Ashraf Shannon, who joins us from Gaza City. Ashraf Shannon, welcome. We know that this anniversary is being marked, and of course Ismail Haniyeh has spoken. Tell us more about what he has said and basically what other officials perhaps have expressed on this anniversary.
Well, Kabi, Hamas's political bureau chief addressed the masses in Gaza who were commemorating the first anniversary of the Sword of Al-Quds battle, in reference to the 11-day war back in May 2021. Basically, Mr. Haniyeh issued a strong warning to the Israeli regime regarding the so-called flag march, which is supposed to take place on the 29th of May, and he also hailed the Palestinian resistance. Palestinian officials today also talked about the increasing might of the Palestinian resistance military wings and also the weakness of the Israeli regime. We've seen during 2021 for the first time Hamas's Izzedine Qassam brigades initiating the war against the Israeli regime in retaliation for the desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds, and also the threats of evicting the Palestinian Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Al-Quds. Also, during that war, we saw the failure of the multi-billion-dollar Iron Dome missile intercepting system that failed to intercept thousands of rockets that were fired from Gaza, Kaveh.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent there from Gaza City, many thanks for that. Let's now introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Charlotte Cates, international coordinator of the Samidun Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network, who joins us from Vancouver. Also joining us is Laith Marouf, activist and political commentator, who joins us from Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, welcome to you both. Charlotte Cates, let me first start with you. We know this operation is the anniversary that was marked today called Al-Quds Sword, executed by the resistance groups from the Gaza Strip. But if you can perhaps give us a check as to why this operation was launched and the reasons behind it, which made the resistance groups to react when they did.
Well, this action by the resistance, this, you know, Battle of Saif al-Quds, was a response, a fundamentally defensive response to the ongoing attacks of Zionist forces, the attempts to continue the ethnic cleansing and eradication of Palestinians in Jerusalem, in Sheikh Jarrah and elsewhere, the ongoing attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque, which we see continuing to this day. And I mean, just the ongoing daily assault of colonization for over 74 years, mass incarceration, land confiscation, home demolitions, extrajudicial killings, assassinations. I mean, the denial of Palestinian refugees' right to return for the past 74 years. And the Palestinian resistance responded to the calls of their fellow Palestinian sisters and brothers in Jerusalem and throughout occupied Palestine and in exile and diaspora, and responded to engage in the confrontation to defend Palestinians as a whole people, not in, you know, separate categories based on their location, but as one people, to defend Palestinians against colonization. And in the process of doing so, the resistance showed in many ways that despite the, you know, over $3.8 billion that the occupation receives every year from the United States and this ongoing and unlimited backing of the imperialist powers in support of the occupation, that it is, in effect, a crumbling system, a crumbling regime that can really be threatened very seriously by the growing power of the resistance. Mm-hmm. And this is something that was seen by everyone around the world. It came hand in hand with what we call, you know, the Unity Intifada, this uprising of people throughout occupied Palestine, showing that popular resistance and armed resistance are one Palestinian struggle for liberation.
Well, Leif Maruf Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas head of political bureau, has said that Al-Quds Ward operation was a turning point in the fight against the Zionist enemy. And this part is what has been highlighted, and it has opened a new and different chapter in that fight. Tell us why Leif Maruf, he has made that statement, and does it go with what our guest there, Charlotte Cates, has said, where the Israeli regime is a crumbling entity in terms of the strength that it used to have, perhaps?
Well, for sure, the Battle of Al-Quds showed a change in all the military balance in the war in Palestine, and we saw clearly that the Israelis couldn't last 11 days and requested this end of hostilities. And unfortunately, the Zionists haven't learned anything from that lesson yet. And we see today the Israeli court that just accepted and approved that Zionists can go on to the Haram al-Sharif, the holy sanctuary, and desecrate it and conduct prayers in front of the Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. So what we saw last year may be repeated very fast right now, coming, approaching even before the March of Flags, as they call it, the Zionists. In the next few days, we may see a return to hostilities. And it would be now a clear example of what the balance of power has changed to. The rockets that were used in the last war by the resistance in Gaza were only its old stock. They didn't use any of the guided missiles that they have. Much of the drone power of the resistance hasn't been used either in the last war, and none of the axis of resistance actors directly got involved in the battle on the ground in Palestine. If the Zionists didn't learn that lesson, the rest of the world who have mental capabilities to calculate what just happened on the ground in Palestine last year have clearly understood that. And we may see a return to these hostilities in the next few days because of the Zionist arrogance.
Well, Charlotte Cates, when you take a look at what has happened, it almost mirrors, in terms of the, somewhat mirrors what happened last year, what happened this year, in terms of the holy month of Ramadan and the way that Al-Aqsa was desecrated and the way that the Israel used heavy-handed tactics against Palestinians. And we could add to that some other developments, or at the time, things that happened, such as that incident in Tel Aviv, for example, where even the Israeli security apparatus came out, and one of their chiefs had said that, yes, our security is actually weakened. But they put that in the context where we were not as cautious as we should be. Do you believe that the Israel security apparatus is weakened at this point, combined with what happened last year?
Well, it certainly is. And I think one of the incidents that shows this the most clearly is the escape or the self-liberation of the six Palestinian prisoners through what's been called the Freedom Tunnel, when six Palestinian prisoners, through using the very limited implements available to them, including, you know, metal spoons and their own ingenuity, created a tunnel outside of one of the most highly guarded, reportedly maximum security Israeli occupation prisons holding Palestinian political prisoners. And when these six prisoners liberated themselves and obtained their freedom, even if only for a short time, they didn't just obtain freedom for themselves and show that Palestinians have a will to obtain freedom despite everything. They also indicated just how weak the previously viewed as impenetrable security of the Israeli prison regime really is. And so just today, when the occupation states sentenced them to, you know, five additional years on the top of the already lengthy sentences that they're serving as people who are being imprisoned for their role in the Palestinian resistance, they made it clear that they're quite proud of their actions, because this sentence is essentially a form of revenge for exposing the weaknesses and fragility of the security state when confronted with the dedication and commitment of the resistance.
I'm wondering, at one point, Laith Maruf, can we say that Israel really needs to reassess the way that it is treating Palestinians, desecrating, for example, their holy places like Al-Aqsa, and of course all the other core issues that constitute violation of Palestinian rights? I mean, taking a look at last year, we're looking at how the resistance groups, they revealed their new weapons technology. They struck everywhere inside the 1948 territories. Israeli airports were on lockdown, I believe, though temporarily, and also showing the way that the rockets penetrated everywhere. Obviously, that needs to put a reassessment outlook for Israel. But why do they continue down this failed practice of what an apartheid regime actually does?
Well, it may sound or look like it's illogical what the Zionists are doing, but the reality of the matter is the tactical options open for the Zionists to achieve their strategic goal of dominance, colonization, and projecting their control over the region is the only options that are available out there to them are either suicide or genocidal. So what we mean by that is that if the Zionists do not assert their dominance by force of genocide, and as we saw the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh last week, then they look weak, and the Palestinians will rise up more and will achieve more of their rights. And if the Zionists actually use force, just like in the case of Shireen Abu Akleh again, in such ways, it actually leads to more Palestinians also rising up. So all the options that are left to the Zionists are negative to them, and they are in a race with time, which is a race that you can't win. The end of Zionism and its the colony is nearer than ever. We see it near and they see it far, as we say in Arabic, and it's they have no options left. So we will see more and more of this, what looks like erratic, irrational actions by the Zionists. And we all have to be ready for them in Palestine and in the region, in the axis of resistance. And this is true on a general scale and on a global scale as the empire starts to crumble and as we see it flagging left and right in the war in Ukraine and the increased pressure on China and Iran. And the assassination just happened today in the streets of Iran of an Iranian officer that served to protect the holy sites in Syria. So here we have another Zionist action that may look very irrational, but that's the only options that are left to them, and the resistance has to be ready to respond in full force, because there's no option to us either.
So if we were to take a look at the ways that what has been categorized as an apartheid regime by many rights organizations, Charlotte Cates, way that it's moving forward, it's jeopardizing its own security even more. And of course, the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh, perhaps like no other time, has really put the spotlight on Israel. One thing that's not really talked about much is how from within, Israel is not really that stable. politically speaking, I believe that they don't have a coalition that is in effect anymore at this point. They don't have the majority. And also the plight of many Israelis, they've opted to migrate out of Israel. Is that another way of looking at the Israeli regime and the way that it has weakened?
Well, there is an ongoing crisis within the settler colonial project, and it's a settler colonial project that is maintained in a constant state of war and aggression against the Palestinian people, the Arab people, and the entire region. And so it's a hostile project that's backed by imperialism, and that's the reason for its existence. And so obviously that is never going to be a stable project that is a normal state having a normal experience. Now, there are these, you know, constant kind of conflicts and contradictions within the Zionist political parties and within the Zionist framework. And one of the things that we far too often see in this context is that we see the Zionist parties competing with one another for how much they want to kill and repress and imprison Palestinians. And so you see the election campaigning within the Zionist state is done at the expense of the Palestinian people. And that's why it is so important to talk about the growing strength of the resistance. And that comes hand in hand. That growing strength of the resistance comes hand in hand with the growing realization and recognition, not just by popular movements, but even by institutions and rights institutions around the world, of the ongoing war crimes and crimes against humanity perpetuated by the Zionist project against the Palestinian people. This kind of competing in elections over the exploitation and oppression of Palestinians is something that should draw horror from people around the world. And of course, in addition, there is the fact that there is that the Palestinian people inside occupied Palestine 48, who have had the Israeli citizenship imposed upon them, have been very active in organizing and protesting and resisting colonization in the Nakba, in resisting colonization throughout occupied Palestine 48, in participating in the Unity Intifada and the uprising throughout occupied Palestine from the river to the sea. And this also includes, you know, the growing and revival of the calls to completely boycott the Knesset elections and reject these systems that are put in place solely to maintain the settler colonial project. So just like any kind of colonial project like this that is installed in a hostile manner to the people, of course, it's always going to be a fragile colonial institution, both internally and externally.
Laith Maruf, if we are looking at the calculations that Israel makes, at this point, you said that they are making the same mistakes again. What is the possibility of them attacking the Gaza Strip? I mean, we're looking at, for example, how this spate of incidents that happened in the month of Ramadan, based on records, marked the deadliest period of attacks in Israel since the year 2006. Do you think that Israel can afford to even wage another war? Because at this point, given all the different things that have happened during the month of Ramadan, which we just skimmed over, and of course topping that would be the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh, that the world would then really turn against Israel were they to wage a war?
Well, truly, this is where we have to understand that the Zionist project is a pillar of imperialism. There's a huge difference, for instance, between South Africa during its apartheid years and the Zionist project right now. One is that the South African apartheid system was not a pillar of imperial projection of power. Without the existence of a Zionist colony, the United States in this empire cannot project power towards much of Asia and Africa. And therefore, we have to be very realistic and understand that there will be no change in the position of any of the components of the empire, including the European states and states like, colonies like Canada and Australia and New Zealand, towards the Zionists, except after their defeat. They will not come to the aid of the Palestinian people even if every citizen in Canada, in the United States, in Europe already is anti-Zionist, those states will not change their position, their existence as dominators over much of Africa and Asia is hinged on this project. And therefore, the continuity of hostilities are at the core of the projection forward. The Zionists have no choice but to create more death and more genocide and create more hostilities towards its neighbors, because they cannot exist without that. And all of us in the region here should be ready for those realities constantly. And I think much of the axis of resistance in its military forces, in Hezbollah, in Hamas, in Islamic Jihad, in the PLFP, in Iran, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, are aware of that reality, and we should prepare our audience for that too.
Charlotte Cates, what do you think? Do you agree?
I think that it is very important to stand with and support the Palestinian resistance and the resistance throughout the region and the camp of resistance around the world. Every day we're seeing ongoing resistance to the imperial order, and we see this from Cuba to Venezuela to Iran to Yemen to Palestine. We see an ongoing resistance to the imperial order on military, financial, and political levels that is growing around the world. And so the Palestinian struggle is part and parcel of that anti-imperialist resistance. There is so much organizing and struggle that is also taking place even within the imperialist countries. Of course, it is the Palestinian resistance and the resistance of the Arab people and the people of the region who will obtain the victory. But it's so important to take action, to do everything that we can to put a stop to this ongoing imperial crimes that are being committed against the Palestinian people and the people of the region and the world. This is why we're seeing things like in Berlin, where just last week, three demonstrations commemorating the Palestinian Nakba were banned. Over 170 people were arrested by the police, and there's this attempt to impose essentially a police state on the Palestinian and Arab community and on anti-imperialist activists in Berlin because of the fact that the German state no longer feels confident in its ability to freely and openly maintain its ongoing collaboration in war crimes and crimes against humanity in occupied Palestine and elsewhere around the world. This is not just a one-off situation of a violation of rights taking place in one country. This is a symptom of the fact that the movement in support of the Palestinian people, in support of the Palestinian resistance, in support of Palestinian liberation from the river to the sea is growing everywhere, okay, including in the heart of the imperialist and settler colonial powers.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Charlotte Cates there, international coordinator, Semidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network. Laith Maruf, thank you.